From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, lawmakers have plenty of questions for the governor's tax-cutting plans. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on the governor's plan to offer college degrees to the state's prisoners. And Senator Gillibrand travels to the North Country to push for a national paid family and medical leave insurance program. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. The legislature finished its hearings on Governor Cuomo's budget proposal and will be ready to start crafting a spending plan once they're back in session after the President's Day break. One of the final hearings focused on the governor's tax-cutting plans, and lawmakers had plenty of questions. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt was there and filed this report.
Legislators at the hearing quizzed Governor Cuomo's tax commissioner on a plan that could result in the freeze of local property taxes. Tax Commissioner Thomas Maddox admits it's a complex plan.
This is clearly a very complicated space.
The governor's proposal relies on local governments and school districts doing several things. First, they would need to agree to limit overall spending increases to 2% or less in the first year of the program. In the second year, they would also have to show that they consolidated some services. In the first 2 years, property taxpayers would get a rebate for any tax charges that are higher than the previous year's levy. It could range from $200 to $500. After the first 2 years, the rebates would be given out based on need in a circuit breaker type system that would reward lower income residents with more money. Senator Liz Krueger, a Manhattan Democrat, asked Commissioner Maddox what would happen, though, if someone lived in a town or city that adhered to the tax freeze requirements, but their school district did not comply.
If I'm a homeowner who lives in a cap-compliant municipality, but my school district is not cap-compliant, what happens to my eligibility for a circuit breaker?
Maddox did not have an immediate answer.
Well, there are several technical aspects like that we will have to work through depending on what the final form of the budget and the legislation takes.
Maddox says the tax department is hoping to set up a website to help homeowners with the details. Even the commissioner, though, seemed confused at times. He said the state would distribute the rebates to taxpayers in the form of checks mailed to their homes this year, but in the future would offer the difference in an income tax rebate. That description contradicted statements by Cuomo's budget director, who said the rebates would always be mailed as checks to property owners. Later, Maddox clarified that the rebates would indeed come in the mail, and he told lawmakers during his testimony that it is a work in progress.
We have some work to do in terms of figuring out how to make this a simple process for homeowners who are eligible to get the exemption.
The complexities of the plan and the difficulties in explaining them caused Senate Finance Committee Chair John DeFrancisco, a Republican from Syracuse, to express some skepticism. He said the proposal as planned
is a nightmare, an absolute nightmare, and you have to administer it.
Senator DeFrancisco does support the concept of a property tax freeze, but he says the plan, as described by Maddox, would require the auditing of millions of New Yorkers' tax returns. Business groups were supportive. Ken Pokalski of the Business Council says plans to cut the corporate tax rate, phase out an energy tax, and offer tax-free options for upstate manufacturers will improve the business climate and the economy.
These business tax reforms and lower business rates will produce important job income and economic benefits to the state.
But some religious leaders oppose the tax plans. Around 40 ministers, rabbis, and other faith leaders held a protest prayer vigil before the hearing began. The Reverend Brooke Newell with the New York State Council of Churches says Cuomo's plan focuses too heavily on tax cuts that benefit the wealthy, including reductions in the estate tax, and not enough on the working poor and the needy.
With a tax plan where the ultra-rich continue to get tax breaks, I pay a higher percentage of my salary in income taxes than the governor does, and I don't make anywhere near as much as he does. So it's about fairness.
Once state lawmakers return from vacation, they'll have about 3 weeks to agree on a tax plan and the rest of the budget. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, I see an agreement in New York on solitary confinement.
Yeah, you know, there are two things that are going on in New York when it comes to our prisons. One is New York has basically signed an agreement that they will not punish people under a certain age, you know, with solitary confinement. You know, I understand it. However, it is important to remember that we have a lot of very important people working in the prison system. And even if you're underage, you can really act out in such a way that you can threaten people's lives, you can kill them, you can murder them. So there are sanctions that are necessary for some people who are in prison who are a danger to the people around them. We remember Donna Payon very well from years ago, who was murdered. And it is important to say, okay, while we can't do certain things, there are other things we can do. It's up to the prison system to figure out what those are, because otherwise you get these informal things that happen often in prisons where guards and others sometimes take the law into their own hands. And that isn't good. That's very bad. So you really have to do it with the sanction of the law and to make sure that it's being done right. Now, there's a second thing that's going on in our prisons, David, and that is that Governor Andrew Cuomo went before the Black and Latino Caucus and said that there was going to be a program implemented which would give college courses to prisoners in certain prisons around New York. This is a very important story, I think, because you have to look a little further than the usual sort of just easy to laugh at. You know, our kids are having to pay for college. These people who are in prison are going to get free college. And the predictable, usual politicians are jumping on the bandwagon. But frankly, not since the gun issue have I seen this Governor Cuomo, who I've been critical of in some cases, have I seen him so courageous. This is a good thing to do because the rate of recidivism in our prisons is alarming. People get out, they can't find jobs, they can't do other things, and so they have to figure it out how to make their way. If you have a college degree, obviously it's much easier than if you don't. And when you consider the number of people who are in prisons of color, you understand that this is just one more continuation of the way in which society has developed over the years, ever since slavery. It's that simple. And so what we're facing is the idea of somehow making a change. And I think Cuomo did the right thing. He's obviously being attacked by cheap tin horn politicians who think it's the easiest way to inflame the public. But in fact, it's a very wise move.
Alan, in other news, the landowners group is suing in state Supreme Court over the issue of hydraulic fracturing. They want the health commissioner to release that report, and they're also saying that the Cuomo administration has been responsible for basically delaying that release.
Do you think? I mean, honestly, the Cuomo administration had a tiger by the tail. Andrew Cuomo was for fracking. That was quite clear in the beginning. He had no idea that the head of the tiger was going to turn around and snap at him, which was his very liberal constituency in New York State, who really felt that you really shouldn't move ahead. And I certainly understand this, until you understand the dangers of fracking. So we don't understand it. We don't really know. Are there people who suspect that Andrew Cuomo has signaled them, take all the time you want? In fact, take several years. And they are, the health commissioner is, for good reason. I mean, if you don't know the answers, you've got to set up studies and controlled studies and everything else to do it. I suspect that anybody can find the right judge. There's something in New York State called judge shopping. You go around, you find the right judge to go to. You say, the health commissioner is taking too long. Judge, you got to force him to do it. I don't know. Maybe you could find a judge who'd do it. But then it's got to go up to the Court of Appeals, which in New York is a fairly liberal institution. And I don't think that they're going to say, yes, commissioner, you have to give a report that you're not ready to give.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chertok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was in Plattsburgh this week to continue her push for federal legislation to create a national paid family and medical leave insurance program. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there and has this report.
New York's junior senator visited the Child Care Coordinating Council of the North Country.
Another one?
She toured the child care facility and interacted with the children for a few minutes before talking about new legislation called the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act, or the Family Act. It updates and amends the 1993 Family and Medical Leave Act. Gillibrand says people should not have to make a choice between earning a wage and being available when a family member desperately needs them.
Today we have guaranteed unpaid leave up to 12 weeks. This will guarantee paid leave for 12 weeks, and it will give them up to 66% of their salary during that time. And know that you will have the flexibility you need to meet that family need.
Mother of three, Kristen DeVoe, described how she lost her job after taking time off when one of her children sustained severe burns and was hospitalized in Boston.
I struggled to make ends meet with three small children. I did the best that I could. I had no money. I'm hoping that this act will help parents like me who have small children, especially one-parent households, get through times like this where you can't work and you have other children to take care of and you have no income and your job is replaced and you have no place to turn. Even though this will not solve all of these problems, it will definitely help.
Senator Gillibrand's measure also guarantees job retention. The Democrat expressed her dismay that the U.S. is the only industrialized nation that does not provide paid family leave. She says our economic system is out of step with the needs of the modern workforce.
The fact that we have no support, we have no paid family medical leave in this country, means that businesses lose out on really good employees, employees that have trained, employees that have been there a long time, because they can't afford to retain that worker with paid leave. So we have to look to how we can change our policies to actually support our workforce today.
Past chair of the New York State Assembly Task Force on Women's Issues and current co-chair of the legislature's Rural Resources Commission, Assemblywoman Addie Russell of the 116th District, says providing paid leave would actually help spur economic growth.
She talked about the fact that this is going to allow our families to be able to make very important choices in a much more palatable manner. Equally, though, we have to talk about how important this is to our business community. Businesses know the value of their employees, and I think they're eager for programs like this, that their employees can know that they have a job to come back to and that they're not going to lose all of that training and all of the resources that they've put into their job and that the employers have put in to their workers.
Paid family leave would be an earned benefit funded through employee and employer contributions. An independent trust fund would be created within the Social Security Administration to administer the program. Gillibrand's measure is patterned after laws in Rhode Island, New Jersey, and California, the only states that have enacted paid family leave.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The future of hydraulic fracturing has been in limbo since the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation began a review of the practice in 2008. Now, six public hearings are being held across New York to receive public comment on the draft state energy plan. One of them was held in Albany this week. Environmental groups were also at the Capitol this week calling on Governor Cuomo to put renewable energy ahead of fossil fuels in his effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2050. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
environmental groups have come together in Albany. They gathered at the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering to comment on the draft state energy plan. Then they headed downtown to the Capitol to continue discussing the plan and call on Governor Cuomo to keep his 2050 commitment and move away from dangerous fossil fuels toward clean and safe energy. John Armstrong is spokesperson for Frack Action and New Yorkers Against Fracking.
That's a great goal, and we are calling on the governor to move away from dirty, dangerous fossil fuels of the past and toward clean and safe energy for New York State, not to invest in any more dirty fossil fuels, including natural gas, and to bring more aggressive renewable energy investment to the state that can lead us to that brighter future and create more jobs at the same time.
Armstrong and the activists make it clear that in order to meet the state's goal of reducing greenhouse gases, the governor must reject fracking.
The energy plan that the governor put out, promising this 80% reduction by 2050, it's very clear that he cannot frack and meet that goal. Bottom line, if he's going to be serious about meeting that climate reduction goal, which is very important to New Yorkers, particularly after Sandy, Irene, and Lee, Governor Cuomo has to reject fracking.
And on the broader issue of the review of fracking,
there has been a very significant and now very rapidly increasing body of science showing harms of fracking, whether it be air pollution, water contamination, seismic activity and concerns about earthquakes, or a range of other health effects that we're seeing in other states where fracking is already going on. Literally, Americans being made sick by poisoned air entering their homes at daycare centers and their schools, or by drinking water that's been tainted by methane and benzene and various other chemicals from the fracking process. As you look at the totality of the science that's coming out on fracking, and that's already there, the only reasonable conclusion is to ban fracking.
Karen Moreau, executive director of the New York State Petroleum Council, says not so fast.
A number of the arguments that they have made simply have not been self-sustaining, simply because this is something that has been occurring in a widespread fashion for many years. There's over 30 states that are using fracking to develop their oil and gas, and the overall safety record is quite strong.
Moreau adds that some of those opposed to fossil fuels, perhaps disillusioned by a perceived lack of momentum as the issue drags on, have turned their attention to other actions like obstructing rail traffic and pipeline construction. Moreau suggests a state like New York, which needs to distribute energy to large population hubs, must leave doors to many options open.
It's better to have a number of eggs in your basket, so to speak, so that if for some reason in one part of the state, there's a, you know, an impediment to delivery. For example, when we had Hurricane Sandy, and the New York City region in particular was in dire straits because they didn't have electricity. In order to have gas stations pumping gas, they needed electrical power. When you have those kinds of situations, it's important that you be able to get the resource there. And where perhaps you couldn't barge because of obstructions in the Hudson River, you could perhaps get the resource into the ports by rail or pipeline, or if a pipeline terminal was disrupted because of a storm. Again, you had another means of getting there. So I think people need to consider that when they start to talk about, well, we don't really like to see this or we don't like to see that. We do really need an all-of-the-above policy for development of infrastructure.
A group of pro-gas drilling landowners from upstate New York filed a lawsuit Friday against Governor Cuomo. The Joint Landowners Coalition of New York, which represents more than 70,000 people spread over 14 counties, said in its lawsuit that Cuomo has overstepped his authority by becoming involved with fracking reviews conducted by the DEC and the Department of Health, and that the involvement has been politically motivated. The Cuomo administration did not return a call for comment in time for broadcast. The state has had a de facto moratorium on fracking for about 5 years, while Health Commissioner Dr. Nirav Shah conducts a health impact review. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Most people think swans are beautiful, but the agreement seems to end there when it comes to a new state plan to manage them. As the Innovation Trail's Joanna Richards reports, a proposal to kill invasive mute swans isn't flying with some animal lovers.
Mute swans are the most familiar swan species to most people. They're big and white with black and orange bills. They're less vocal than other swans, which is how they got their name. In the 1800s, people captivated by their looks brought them from Europe and Asia to North America to adorn ponds and gardens. But over time, they've moved into the wild, and now biologists say they pose a threat to native wildlife. For one thing, they eat a lot.
Each adult bird will consume somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 pounds of submerged aquatic vegetation a day.
Paul Curtis studies human-wildlife conflict at Cornell University.
That could be close to a ton of vegetation a year per swan.
Curtis says that vegetation is also food for native water birds and nursery habitat for invertebrates and fish. Mute swans can also aggressively defend their nests, leaving coastal areas inaccessible for other birds and people. And their waste can raise bacteria levels in water. That's why the Department of Environmental Conservation wants them gone, especially along Lake Ontario, where their numbers have been increasing over the past 2 decades. Brian Swift is a state biologist who helped develop the new management plan.
We need to remove the animals, and shooting is the most efficient way for us to do that in most cases.
The plan aims to eliminate all free-ranging mute swans from the state by 2025. It includes other control strategies, like oiling eggs to prevent them from hatching, moving birds to private collections, banning their importation, and encouraging better management in neighboring states. But what's gotten the most attention is the DEC's proposal to kill the birds when possible, something it's already done on occasion, but would ramp up, along with other containment efforts. Janelle Barabash is a Brooklynite whose petition against the plan has garnered over 34,000 signatures.
Our solution is birth control. I think non-lethal, humane containment is the answer.
The problem with sterilization for any long-lived species is that you can stabilize population growth, but it takes many, many years potentially to see any reduction in numbers.
Curtis says the outcry over killing mute swans has to do with what made them appeal to North Americans in the first place, their beauty. The DEC Swift agrees.
Maybe if it was a less appealing species like our Eurasian boars, we didn't get the same response to an eradication program for those animals.
Barabash acknowledged the bird's beauty is part of why she's opposed to killing them. Upstate, things might be different, she said. But in New York City, mute swans have become a rare symbol of the grandeur of nature. Curtis and Swift contend that killing the swans is what's best for nature. The DEC is accepting public comments on its draft plan until February 21st. For the Innovation Trail, I'm Joanna Richards in Watertown.
And that about does it for this week. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1408, or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.